Jones Live today, Thursday the 11th of April. On this edition, we ask how François Hollande, how much he's achieved as French president so far. And we'll look at another new initiative beginning to widen access to St Andrews. I'll be finding out what difference it will really make. After 5:30, Erin Lyons from The Saint will explain why St Andrews is awarding better degree classes than a decade ago. And finally, on the week former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher died, we will take a look at her legacy. That's all here on Alexander Jones Live. And don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter and join the conversation there. You can find me at Mr. Jones News. We begin today by turning our attention to France. President François Hollande has caused controversy over his attempts to moralise the French tax system. Having held the French presidency since May 2012, Hollande is now facing low approval ratings, whilst politicians across the country face their lowest ratings as well. So what has Hollande actually achieved so far, and what sort of shape is France in today? I'm joined by Anas Morjan, a French student here in St Andrews, who is opposes Monsieur Hollande, and is quite happy to say so, I think, here. So welcome to the programme. And so how would you sum up, in one sentence, what he has achieved in his first year in office?
Well, I can actually pretty summarise that in two words, and that would be not much. you've underlined that very well. Basically, François Hollande right now, François Hollande mandate, François Hollande's government, is facing three problems in France nowadays. Three crises that he seems to have like most difficulties like trying to resolve. First of all, he's like trying to face an economic crisis. France is in really bad shape in terms of the economy. The growth this year actually like predicted by Brussels and adopted by the French Ministry of for Finances is going to be 0.1% and like way lower than the government's prediction. Second of all, it's actually also like facing a social crisis, and we've seen that over the last 11 months. We've seen a more defiant French society. We've seen French pitch against one another. We've seen the huge issue, for example, of the social plan that is gay marriage that has been not very well handled by the government. And third of all, the government is currently facing a huge political crisis, as you just underlined, with the recent Cahuzac affair, the scandal, this budget minister who lied to the whole country, budget minister who was entitled, like, charged by François Hollande to actually execute France's economic policy that has turned into austerity, a budget minister who lied to the country about having an illicit offshore account in Switzerland. So basically, François Hollande is in relatively bad shape now, even like pretty much. The polls getting really low. Last poll last week actually gave him 70% of people actually disapprove of his action, and you've said that as well. The French society and French people in general are more and more defiant towards power, towards the presidency, towards the government, but also towards traditional political parties as a result. And as a consequence, I do not believe that the policies led by François Hollande so far are up to the challenge that like actually is, requires the situation of France right now.
Let's deal with the first of those points to begin with, and that was about the economic growth figures and how France has done worse than expected. And if we look across Europe, France is by no means unique in that. And actually here in Britain, the same's happened. And actually in Britain, the government's on the right. And they're having the same problems. So can that really be attributed to him?
Well, can we actually describe France and Britain having the same problems? I don't think so. Great Britain has actually led for all like austerity policies since the accession of power, like to David Cameron. That was actually, to my sense, the right thing to do. Well, then again, if you compare like British and French models, I do not believe that it can like total austerity policies as it has been led in Britain would work in France. However, the policies led by François Hollande actually nowadays in France could in no way lead to a better economic growth. We've seen austerity policies which are based differently, for example, which is not the case in Great Britain, on fiscal pressure. François Hollande basically decided, when he decided to lead his austerity policy, decided to raise taxes and not to cut spending. 95% of the actual austerity policy that is led now in France is based on raised taxes and more fiscal pressure, which is completely different in Great Britain, where actually like cutting and spending. And this has resulted in a terrible, terrible shock for the French economy. We have more to that. We actually have seen like this This is not good for the small enterprises. This is not good for the small and middle enterprises, basically constitute the backbone of the French economy. This is not good for talents. This is not good for competitivity, which is the backbone of how you actually get an economy back on the right road. And this has provoked France to actually not see the end of the actual financial and economic crisis that has begun in 2008. And I honestly do not believe that this is the right policy to lead. We should be leading more of an economic policy more based on competitivity, on actually relieving small and middle businesses from the fiscal pressure to actually know and not actually focus on more fiscal pressure and less spending cuts.
I guess, again, there's two issues here that we're looking at. One is how far Hollande's policies are the right thing to do. And clearly you disagree with almost all of them, a lot of what he's doing.
Well, a lot. But I mean, he has impressed, obviously, the fundamental problem with François Hollande is actually not from my point of view, but from the French people point of view, is that he led a very left-wing campaign promising things he knew he wouldn't be able to actually enforce once in power. And the last presidential election in France basically was much more based on the rejection of the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, much more than the actual enthusiasm for the election of François Hollande. And I do think, and French people seem to actually think with me, that they actually realize that they did not vote for someone lacking as much enthusiasm, charisma, and leadership qualities as François Hollande. Well, then again, in terms of policies, he has engaged a few policies that actually are in what France needs right now and in France's interest. The only problem is with this policy is, for example, we do have to recognize he has actually committed to lower the country's deficit and lower the meet the European requirements, even though he's probably going to fail by the end of this year and recognize it so. But the problem is, he's not going to get to the end of it. He's never going to get to the end of it because the policies that actually led by the socialist government, by François Hollande, are not, they're not convinced. And basically, this leads to all this situation I've described. We have an economic crisis basically longing up. We have a social crisis with longs, and we have a political crisis because French people are tired of seeing politicians promising things, not being able to keep them, and as a result, actually turning to more extremist parties, as for example the far right National Front, Front National, or the far left Front de Gauche. So we are needing some more energetic policies. We are needing an economic shock and more daring, more bold economic policies, more political reforms to actually get out of this mess we actually got on. And I do not believe that François Hollande, in the actual shape he is in, if he doesn't take immediate measures to actually get remedies to that, is going to be able to do so.
But we're seeing trust in all politicians across France, as I said in my introduction, is very low. So actually, yes, a change of policies or new policies from another party, actually, is that really going to make a difference? Because what we're seeing is the public not just rejecting François Hollande, not just rejecting the Socialist Party, they're rejecting politics.
Because, yes, absolutely. And they said, because we had basically the same problem with Nicolas Sarkozy beforehand as well. French people have been deceived, with an extraordinary campaign led by Sarkozy in 2007, and reforms that, if they existed, might have not been up to the French people's expectations due to the financial crisis. We had a democratic alternance with the election of François Hollande, and this one just proves, as the others, that he's not going to succeed or at least achieve much. At least he didn't achieve much in the last 11th month. So the normal reaction to that, and we are going through a major financial crisis, is obviously French people turning into more extreme political parties, parties that have never been into power, and parties that seem to be, who has never participated in the political game, and therefore seemed more trustworthy. However, I do not think that this is going to have a great and a major influence in French politics, and I do believe it's going to last until the next presidential election and heavily influence it. But I do not think that the time of these parties gaining enough influence to actually pretend conquering power has actually come. If 70%, last poll actually said, like say last week, 70% of people actually denounce François Hollande and dissatisfied with François Hollande, if a majority of people, over 50% of French people actually are more broadly dissatisfied with French politics and other parties, the UMP or the Socialist Party, but also extremist parties, they also, more than 70% to actually disapprove of these extremist parties that are on the National Front and the left wing, the far left wing party that is the Front Gauche. So basically, what we're like actually acknowledging here is that French people are looking for an alternative in terms of policies, and they do not like simply they do not recognize it. They don't see it in the governing majority in the governing party that is the Socialist Party, and they may be waiting for it from the main opposition party, the UMP, who needs to actually get more ideas to actually propose something, get an opposition project and oppose itself to the socialist government, but seems also to be in a bad shape following the internal elections of last fall. So following that, we have two extremist parties who actually like benefit from that, but I do not believe that this is unavoidable consequence of the state of France. Now, there's still hope, and it's up to François Hollande, because he's in power, but also to the opposition parties and the UMP to actually get propositions to get the country back on track.
So, in the last few days, we've seen Hollande make comments about abolishing tax havens. Mm-hmm. And while I would think very few people are unlikely to disagree with the sentiments again, here it comes down, I think, to the point you raised about implementation. How helpful are these comments? Is he likely to be able to do anything practical?
Well, it all depends, again, because you just underline it. It's obviously very, very difficult to actually implement these policies. And it all does not only depend on the actual will, which is always a good will. Everyone agrees with the fact that we should ban fiscal havens from economic and financial practices. Right steps and steps in the right direction have been set by the present government, and not only the French government. This is more of a problem that I do believe is to be tackled at the European level, and is going to be tackled at the European level. That's a good thing, in coordination with all of France's partners, because it doesn't only concern France, obviously Great Britain as well, Germany, which surprisingly enough we didn't talk about yet, and all these countries. In terms of implementation, though, it's probably going to take a long time. It's also going to depend on the Great Britain's goodwill. Everyone knows that Great Britain is also kind of ambiguous on these questions, actually detaining some fiscal havens on its own. And that's something the French do not see and do not particularly see with really kindly, let's say. And that's something that needs to be tackled at a European level. So, right steps have been set in the right direction by the president's administration. We had Sarkozy Brown when he was prime minister partnership in 2009. The G20 and all these rules that have been actually set to ban fiscal havens. It hasn't been enough. Let's be honest. We still need to actually enforce these rules and push forward in this direction. And that is something that is going to be discussed. Let's be optimistic about that. We're going to see and see how this results in the European level. Yeah.
Finally, and briefly to end, mm-hmm. Where do you see this situation going in a few years' time? Are we going to see Hollande actually losing more support and then losing the next election? Or is he going to claw it back a bit as Europe comes out of the recession?
Well, it all depends on two levels. It depends on the French level and the European level. On the French level, François Hollande has actually two choices. He can change policies and apply policies that can actually put France back on the right economic trail and improve the country's economy, provide the country with more jobs, and actually get his approval ratings up because he does the right job. That's not something I actually see happening in the next few years. That'll probably lead into a rise in the opposition and probably the UMP, but that's something we're going to see. At the European level, this problem is not going to be solved only at the national level. We are the state, like an age where nation states, and especially in Europe, actually don't have all the solutions to that key problem that, like globalization and finance. And that's something that is also going to be tackled at the European level. And like something that actually makes me pessimistic about that is that the Franco-German partnership, which has been the key and fuel of European construction, up until now is in a very fragile state due to the very cool relations between François Hollande and Angela Merkel. So that's, again, something that doesn't like get me to have very optimistic predictions for the future of France in the next few years. But again, let's be optimistic for France's sake and the country, Europe's sake.
Anas, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Alex.
Yet another initiative has been launched to try and widen access to the university. St Andrews student ambassadors have launched the scheme calling Beyond Fife to raise the aspirations of Scottish secondary pupils. The SRC member for widening access is Avalon Borg, and she joins me now. She was there on the very first school visit. Was that earlier this week, last week?
It was March 22nd, I believe. Okay. So a few weeks ago.
And you've been on that. What exactly is this initiative supposed to do?
Basically, it is a student-led project. Therefore, the university, we're not going on behalf of the university, rather as students going to share our experiences. And the way I see the project is we had two aims. Firstly, it was to present pupils that, you know, we're all different students. We all come from different backgrounds. So, for example, there was Carrie, who's the vice principal ambassador for widening participation, who basically organized this entire project. It's her baby. So, you know, she came from a state school. So that was one set person. The second was Freddie, association president, who comes from England and received private education. And thirdly, myself, an international student who went to a state school in Canada. So just presenting students that the University of St. Andrews embodies a wide variety of students, not just sort of the students clad in barbers and hunter wellies that the media decides to pick up on. And secondly, something I decided to focus on was that university is more than just academics. It's about choosing the place where you want to grow up. And it's very much the people around you and the environment that shapes who you become and sort of what kind of life you carry after university. And I think that's quite a profound thing to present to 16 and 17-year-old pupils. I know when I was in high school, I didn't think of university anything more than just academics.
Is there not a danger in sending this sort of variety of people, so international student, state school, private school, the likes of Freddie, is there not a danger that they could actually scare people away from coming to St Andrews because it reinforces the image?
You know what? I think we didn't know what we were going to expect. We were wary of, you know, what kind of response. But I think we went there as students on a very sort of casual level. And I don't think there was any danger. It was nice to finally get out from the offices discussing widening participation and finally get into the schools and be face to face with these students. And in fact, I think we got a really great response. We were actually one of the very first universities to even show up and make a presence at Falkirk High School. I think that in itself is quite a profound thing. Students talking to future students who may be thinking about university. And it was really, really great. And one of the teachers there after was talking to us, and he said something quite sort of confirming that we were doing something right, that he said about 10 students probably weren't even thinking about attending university before that talk, but he knew that he'd have 10 more kids in his guidance counselor office thinking about putting together a UCAS application.
So it's definitely being helpful, you're suggesting, for the schools it's going to, but it is only going to 15 schools. How much of a difference can this really make?
So far, it's a pilot project. I mean, we've been met with funding from the university to carry this on for the next 3 years. And I mean, those are 15 schools that have agreed to participate.
Is that 15 schools a visit every year for 3 years?
I'm not too sure what the specific details are. Carrie's been working really, really hard to get schools to cooperate. It's not just us going. That's not what's stopping us. It's getting agreement from other schools and things like that. And she's worked incredibly hard and given a lot of time and effort to putting that together. So I think the next, well, for example, my term for a member of Widening Access has ended. And so for the future, people who decide to hold that position and run for it really need to make sure this project stays on track.
Freddie Ford, to quote him again, has said that this is a big step forward. But will anyone in St Andrews, apart from the small number of people who are actually going to the schools, will anyone notice the difference?
I don't think it's our place as students to notice the difference. The difference needs to be made with the students considering whether or not they want to attend university in general. I mean, we showed up there saying that, you know, St. Andrews may not be the place for you, but think about higher education in a more wider sense. And St. Andrews isn't for everyone. And we made that very, very clear that after this presentation, maybe you'll realize that St. Andrews isn't for you. I think as students, it's important that we realize we have a greater role than just attending, you know, lectures and societies and maybe, I don't know, having more of a presence in our previous high schools and letting our, I don't know, younger generations know what university in general has to offer.
Again, I'm interested by the fact that we're funding it from the university here, mm-hmm. but we're not actually encouraging them to come here. It's only to university in general.
Well, I mean, it's student-led. So we've made the decision that we explicitly say that we're here to tell you about higher education. We're here to tell you about what St. Andrews has to offer, and this may not be for you. And I think that is more effective than preaching what St. Andrews has to offer exclusively because it's not as valuable. I mean, the funding is simply just to get there and back. So basically, petrol.
So it's not a lot of money.
It's not a lot of money, but at the end of the day, it's still a nice commitment from the admissions office.
So there is a lot more that they could do.
There's always more the university can do. And I'll say that until the very day I graduate. The university can always do more. And that's something that students need to sort of fight for, right? And show and demonstrate to the university that more is needed.
Again, I just wonder whether this is a cynical PR attempt from the university, because we're seeing 15 schools, mm-hmm. pilot scheme, 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's relatively long term if we want to see it increased at all. And so in the short term, actually, are they just hoping for a few good headlines in the papers to counteract mm-hmm. some comments that Louise Richardson's made about fees and things like that?
One thing I think I need to correct you on, or whatever the media has picked up on, is that it's not the university. This is student-led. And I think that's what's going to separate us from certain university initiatives. This is student decisions. We decided we wanted to go out into schools beyond Fife. It's not even necessarily beyond Fife. We didn't really agree on a proper name for it. It's more than that. I think it kind of condemns this weird notion. Anyways, but it's student-led. It's a student initiative. We're not going on behalf of the university. We've secured funds to get us there and back from the university. But ultimately, we're not going on behalf of the university. So it's not anything to do with them.
But they are funding it. Did you consider actually trying to fund it completely independently from the university?
We could have gotten money from the union. And I think we've only been to one school, and on the car ride back, we did discuss maybe shifting the funds to come partly from the union. So it's a joint effort between funding from the union and funding from the university, just to reinforce that it is student-led. And we do have the funds in the union, so I think that's something that kind of needs to be worked out.
Yeah, because although you're saying it's a student-led thing, mm-hmm. You can't have complete independence from the university all the time they're providing the funding.
You'd think that, but when we were to check with some of the VPs in admission trying to double check, is this PowerPoint okay? They really just didn't want to see it. They said, just do your own thing. This is student-led. This is your baby. Go for it. So while you think the funds would implicate that they are sort of watching what we're doing, and they're not. I can assure you that it has been 100% student-led, and there's been very, very little feedback or input from anybody from admissions or the widening participation sort of department.
You said that your year as SLC member for widening access is now up, and mm-hmm. that there's always more that can be done. What other things have been done in the course of your year, and how new is this project?
This project is extremely new. Like I said, it's Carrie who has contacted the schools. She's from Fife, so she has these amazing links and has worked very hard to establish them. Something else that I focused on in my role is to look for sort of a way to fix international student fees, because they are not regulated by anything currently. And I think that's a great injustice to students. that the university arbitrarily raises our fees by over £1,000 each year. That's something I've worked with. Haven't gotten as far with that as I'd like, but I really have full faith in the SABs next year to take that on as a project and get more students involved and aware of what happens to our fees.
And generally, have you found the whole process to be quite positive in actually building up relationships with the university and with the wider community as well?
I think it's been difficult, especially fighting for the international student fees. But I mean, when it comes to numbers and money with this university, you're always going to be met with slight resistance and a slow timeline into getting things done. But overall, it's been a very enlightening experience. I've learned to care about things that I wouldn't have 6 months ago. So I would wholly recommend getting involved in the union, and especially, you know, fighting for student rights, especially when it comes to tuition fees, as it's going to be a challenge for the next generation of students, for sure.
Avalon, thank you very much for joining us here on the programme. And still to come, we will be discussing the headline from today's Saint, asking about the number of first-class degrees that have been given here at St Andrews, and then later on we'll be discussing the legacy of the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, former Prime Minister, who died on Monday. But now, it's 5:30 and time for the latest from Star News.
Guest list for Thatcher funeral release.
An investigation to build new human rights in
Live from Star Studios, this is Star News.
With the 5:30 Star News, I'm Susanna Saban.
I'm Verity Mason.
And I'm Michael Cottrell.
Downing Street has released a preliminary guest list for former Prime Minister Baroness Margaret Thatcher's funeral. Invitations will be sent out to over 2,000 individuals, including all surviving US presidents and British Prime Ministers. The Queen has already confirmed her attendance, making this the first funeral of a British politician she has attended since the death of Sir Winston Churchill in 1965. Other invitees include a representative from the Reagan family, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Labor leader Ed Miliband. The guest list was compiled by members of Thatcher's family and the Conservative Party. The funeral is set to take place next Wednesday at St. Paul's Cathedral in London.
A new investigation has discovered that Egyptian army doctors were ordered to operate without anesthesia during protests against military rule. The investigation commissioned by President Mohamed Morsi was instigated to explore allegations of military and police malpractice during the Abbasia clashes in May 2004. The report contains testimony from doctors about mistreatment of injured protesters at the military hospital in Cairo. The findings are the latest evidence of human rights abuses since the start of the 2011 uprising that toppled Morsi in Cairo. Other allegations include torture,
opening debate on the president's gun control measures. Gun control advocates in the Senate defeated a filibuster attempt by opponents with a final 68-31 voting result. 4 months after the shooting of Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, the United States is preparing to take on gun control over the coming months.
A man in Belarus has been bitten to death by a beaver. The man, who was on a fishing trip with friends, stopped to take a picture of the beaver. As he approached, the beaver pounced on him and bit his thigh. His friends tried to help, but unfortunately the man died on the scene. Beaver attacks are rare, and according to experts, are usually the result of rabid animals.
And finally, the weather. Tonight, cloudy with some light rain, spreading across all parts overnight. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy and cold, with occasional rain.
And those are today's headlines. For more news, tune in to our bulletin tomorrow at 5:30, or online anytime on the news section of the Star website.
to Alexander Jones live here on Star. Thank you to the news team for that. And still to come, we will be discussing in a few minutes' time the legacy of Margaret Thatcher, the former Prime Minister who died on Monday. This morning's Saint led with the headline that in the last decade, the number of first-class degrees being awarded by the university has doubled. That is the headline that shocked today's Saint, and I'm joined by its author, Erin Lyons. Welcome to the programme.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, what's going on here? More degrees at a higher level? Is this dumbing down from the university?
Well, the university maintains that it's let in a lot more high-quality graduates. It's put its application levels up, and it'd be worried if the results weren't going up as well. I mean, and this is part of a national trend, of course, which is seeing first class and 2-1 degrees going up across the board, and we're not unique in this respect. But
see, in many ways, it's that bit, the national trend, that suggests the dumbing down. You can buy into their argument that they've let in a higher quality of student, but if this is happening across the whole country, well, they can't all be letting in a higher quality of student.
I mean, I've been thinking about this, and part of it, I think, might be to do with the different way we're assessed now to how we were in the past. I mean, talking to one of my tutors, who sort of roughly was doing his degree about 10 years ago or so, he said that, well, he was assessed at the end of 2 years of honours level study, and he didn't have any coursework. And if you take that into account, that might be to do with some of the trend.
So actually what we're seeing is that although maybe the content isn't harder to grasp, it's being made easier to actually pass exams or through continuous assessment, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, no matter where you fall on whether it's being dumbed down or not, employers are definitely worried, and that's really the main concern for graduates. I mean, I think possibly the answer is to change the system, because like if you have, for employers, the cutoff rate will be if you've got a 2-1 or not. And the difference between someone who's got a very high 2-1 and a 2-2 is very different to, say, a low 2-2, a low 2-1 and a 2-2. So there's a big difference between both ends of the 2-1.
And increasingly, you really do need a 2-1 to actually get employment of any into graduate schemes or postgrads. You require that level of academic achievement. So is it just that people feel more pressure to work harder because they know that classification matters more?
I mean, certainly. It's no longer the amount of people getting degrees has astronomically gone up. And if you sort of, getting a degree isn't enough anymore. You have to have a very good degree from a very good university to get anywhere.
Again, that point of the university, St Andrews is supposed to be one of the top universities. So in that sense, does that mean that actually people are less bothered by the classification as to say, actually, you got into St Andrews, it's difficult to get in, therefore you must be pretty good, we'll give you a shot?
I think that's going to have a lot to do with it. I mean, a first from Oxford compared to a first from somewhere low down the league table, it isn't going to be the same. I mean, just a degree class isn't going to be the difference between whether you do well or not.
And the changes that you suggest have been made, obviously any reversion to final exams after 2 years or even 4 years, anything that's pushing it to one block would meet a lot of opposition from students, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think it would meet a lot of opposition from staff as well. I don't think they thought that was a very good system either. From what I've observed, they seem to think it was a lot more of memorisation and cramming rather than assessing you on how well you've understood the information and can sort of apply that.
Yeah, because again, I think assessment's actually a really an interesting area to focus on here, because it's something that we're seeing even evolving now. Yesterday I was at a meeting about advising where they were suggesting that more modules are going for 100% coursework than ever before. And with that change, a lot of the students are actually, they love the idea of 100% coursework. Is it really better for them? Is it easier?
It depends on how you actually do in exams. I mean, I know a lot of people get incredibly stressed by exams, and coursework can be a lot more on how you do, how you'll apply that information later, which is surely probably the point of learning it in the first place, rather than how will you cope in a particular very stressed environment of the exam hall.
Yeah, and again, I probably actually goes back into the school system as well and the changes that have been made there. And in Scotland now, we're seeing the system changing as well. And in England, there's talk about various reforms that Michael Gove is making, and New Labour made various changes over their time in office. Do you think that that's having an effect on university as well? Because from the bottom up, they're having to change the system.
I mean, that's the argument, that you're not just seeing these changes at university. University is very much sort of the knock-on effect of GCSE, A-level, and obviously Scottish Higher reforms that have gone on across the board in the last decade or so. And really, yeah.
One of the things that will make St Andrews different to many of the other universities is that it really isn't a global marketplace. A third of our students are from outside Britain. What difference does that make when looking at universities in other countries? How do they do this sort of thing?
I mean, there's been a suggestion by certain academics of bringing in the sort of American system of a GPA, which would be very personalised. I mean, I think in general, you can get too focused on the degree classification, and what employers are being forced to do, and I think is probably a good thing, is look at what else you were doing at university. The different clubs, societies, the different things you were doing that set you apart.
And I guess one of the other systems that works here is that medics all get ranked against each other in their year. They know exactly where they came, not just by who got this grade in the class. They know that they were number 20 out of however many. Do you think that sort of thing makes a difference as well? Do employers want to know that sort of information and exactly where you sit?
I mean, I think increasingly they do. They want an academic breakdown of exactly what you're getting, what you got in, say, your dissertation, what you got in each module you were taking. And that's sort of how they're differentiating. I'm not sure necessarily ranking would be the way to go. I'm not sure how well that would foster a healthy student environment. But
yeah, and again, in the moment, at the current time, we're in economic crisis, it can still be said. And it's still very difficult to get jobs for graduates. Could it be said that actually when the times get better again, presuming that they are going to, give it 5 years, give it 10 years down the road, and actually employers will want graduates again, there won't be problems, and actually this problem will just fade away again?
I'm not necessarily sure that'll be the case. I mean, I think once you get to having a more pressured and higher calibre and quality looked at of students, I'm not necessarily sure HR staff are going to want to go back to, as long as you've got a good degree, that'll do.
Yeah, and you think that generally, have the university been quite supportive of the changes that have been made to the degrees? Do they generally feel that it's a positive move forward?
In terms of higher level of numbers getting good results.
Yeah. Are they generally positive about that?
Yeah, they say that there is an issue with the system as a whole of degree classification, but they seem confident that the numbers reflect a higher level of quality, that they stand behind that.
And we are increasingly seeing higher entrance requirements to St Andrews. So again, to take their first fair point where they're saying that more higher standard of students in equals higher standards out, is that a trend that's going to increase again? Because we've even seen the year after mine, the year that just the current freshers had even higher entrance requirements for a number of subjects. So can we expect that in like 5-10 years that this trend will continue and more people will hit the top marks?
I mean, I think that's what's probably actually quite worrying, because I mean, how much higher can you go than 85% of students, and when does it become meaningless that almost as soon as you get in you're going to get a 2-1 or a first? I mean, I think that calls into question the degree classification, because when does it become a bit meaningless?
And originally the second class degree was that, and it was then split into the 2-2-2-1. Do we need another split to make it more helpful?
That has been another suggestion. The suggestion is that you have a first and then sort of like a first star, first plus. I mean, the same thing's happened with A-levels. Now you have an A-star as well as the ABC ranking. I mean, I'm not sure how much that'll affect things. I think probably a split in the 2-1 would be more helpful, just to sort of differentiate between that quite big pool of students.
Erin, thank you very much for speaking to me on the programme today. Thank you. On Monday, there was just one story across the news in Britain. Former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the only woman to have ever taken to the reins of Downing Street, had died. And this cued endless hours of legacy talk. And today, well, we're going to take our own look at what she did and what difference her premiership makes to our lives today here at university in Scotland. Michael Cotterill is a member of the Star News team and a self-confessed admirer of Thatcher, who joins me now. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
So, I must have heard the phrase this week, love her or loathe her, hundreds of times across all the coverage. She was undoubtedly a divisive figure, wasn't she?
Oh, absolutely. She polarised opinion from her very first years in office. Winston Churchill once said, some politicians make the weather. Well, indeed, some politicians do make the weather, but Margaret Thatcher was a tornado. She transformed British politics. What she did, she shifted the centre of gravity from Keynesianism to neoliberalism. Before 1979, Britain had operated under the mentality of the post-war consensus, and that was mainly about like Keynesianism with a big state, with the state intervening in economic affairs. She changed all of that. Her ideology was about rolling back the frontiers of the state, privatising, reducing taxation. And to some extent, we are living under that mentality today, the one that she implemented and introduced.
And that had ramifications around the globe, didn't it? What sort of effect did her system have elsewhere?
Well, she initiated, really, the transferal from Keynesianism to neoliberalism in the sphere of economics. Veganism came after her, and really that revolution went all the way around the world. She was in vogue, if you like, in terms of economic theory.
So the current economic system can be attributed to Thatcher.
Absolutely.
And the change she made.
Yeah.
Can she be blamed for the economic crisis? Is that fair?
No, I don't think that's fair at all. She was last in power in November 1990.
But if we're still living under her system, the system that she changed and set going, then surely it's her fault that it all went wrong.
Well, I mean, you have to look at it from both perspectives. I mean, some people will say that the main cause of the 2008 financial implosion was Labour's overspending. However, some people will say that it was caused by, if you like, Thatcherism, you're right, and because he rolled back the frontiers of the state too much, and there was too much deregulation, and that led to financial irresponsibility. I mean, only history will decide whether she was like right or wrong in that regard, and history changes over time. So there will be times when her ideas will be back in vogue again, but sometimes they'll not be popular at all.
How significant was it that she was a woman?
I think it was very significant. She was elected in 1959, and she worked in Westminster when it was a very male-dominated world. And the fact that she climbed the very greasy pole shows that she was a truly remarkable, exceptional woman.
It provides quite a few problems for feminists, this, because actually, in many ways, Thatcher climbed the pole despite feminists, not because of them. She was self-confessed as actually hating feminism. So this does provide them with quite an issue, because really, they want, on one hand, they want to celebrate the fact there's been one woman prime minister, that's now happened. But on the other hand, then many of them don't actually agree with her policies. How do you think that she should be remembered for in that sense?
Oh, she definitely wasn't a feminist at all. She only ever had one cabinet member who was a woman, and that was Baroness Young. And she was put in the office of Leader of the House of Lords, which wasn't a very influential position. In her cabinet, it was mostly men. She was like the only man in the cabinet, if you like, even though she was a woman, because she dominated them so much. But what I think is very interesting is why she didn't promote many other women to the cabinet, because there are many well-qualified, very capable women MPs in the Conservative Party, but she didn't promote them to the cabinet. Why didn't she do this? And Shirley Williams actually has a very interesting analysis of this topic, because at the time, all of the Tory MPs in the cabinet members, they were very posh and they had lots of money. They were probably brought up by a nanny. And then they would go to school, and then the matron would be a very dominating figure in the school premises. And what you have there is a deep-seated fear of women and a desire not to challenge women who hold positions of authority. And the male members of the cabinet didn't quite know how to challenge her. I mean, she would say some outlandish ideas and policies, but they wouldn't challenge her because they'd be scared to do that.
Yeah, and again, that's a point that it's really worth following up on, because she's got this reputation for the way she dealt with her cabinet colleagues as well. But she did want to dominate there, didn't she? She wanted to be the lead figure in everything.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, I mean, if you look at, say, the Iron Lady, there's a scene with her almost yelling at her cabinet colleagues. And I mean, sometimes, I mean, when they should have individual meetings with her cabinet colleagues, sometimes they'd like leave in tears because she had done so much research and she wasn't impressed that they hadn't like done their portfolio so well, didn't know what they were talking about. So she would absolutely thrash them in argument. But then again, she was capable of enormous acts of kindness to her personal staff. She was very kind to her secretaries and most other people dealt with. There was a famous case, Paddy Ashton was talking on the BBC, and he said he was walking down the stairs of number 10, and his wife was there, and his wife's very left-leaning. Margaret Thatcher was walking up the stairs. There was a do for a foreign ambassador, and they chatted for a while, and Paddy Ashton's wife like hissed afterwards, after Margaret Thatcher continued walking up the stairs, "Damn it, she's a charming woman." So even though she was quite venomous in the pursuit of her political ideals, she was very charming in the personal sense.
She's attributed with many things, positive or negative, depending on your position. How much of that is true and how much of it is just a myth that's developed over time?
Sorry, what do you mean? Like talking about the myth of Thatcherism?
Well, how much of Thatcherism is a myth? How many of her ideas really were attributed to her? How many of her policies really actually happened in the way that people claim to remember them now? Because her supporters and her haters alike both claim things which can't all be true.
Yes, you're correct. Mythology does seem to have developed. People either loved her or loathed her. There are very few people in between. I mean, I like to have a balanced argument as a Liberal Democrat because I recognise the virtues of many of her policies. Looking at Britain in 1979, it was an absolutely terrible state. There was an economic malaise, and she shook Britain from head to toe and gave it confidence in itself again. But then again, one has to look at the repercussions of Thatcherism in many depressed communities in the north. She exacerbated the depression of many communities, especially the mining communities. I mean, the problem, yes, I mean, just let's look at the case study of the miners' strike. The mining industry was overspending by £1 billion every single year, and that was taxpayers' money. That money could have been spent on schools, on hospitals, on infrastructure development, but instead it was spent on the miners, and that debt was happening every single year. And she said, well, this isn't on. This is public money. It should be better spent than that. So she challenged the miners, and that was led by Arthur Scargill. I mean, the thing with Arthur Scargill is that he was a revolutionary, a self-purported revolutionary. He wanted to roll back the years of Thatcherism and overthrow a democratically elected government. I mean, yes, many miners don't like her, but I think many miners today recognise that they were led by a deranged person, and he didn't offer them a ballot. So the strike, the miners' strike, which lasted for a year, wasn't legal at all, because Arthur Scargill knew that if he did conduct a ballot, most of the members would vote against it. But still, I think the fact that Margaret Thatcher didn't have a big strategy to rejuvenate the mining areas, because when you see in the mining areas, there'd be one industry that would completely dominate it. There wouldn't be any other jobs in that area. And if you extract that industry, people don't have any jobs, and it's very difficult for some people to be economically mobile. So those years have been in depression for like 30 years now. And Margaret Thatcher didn't have a strategy to rejuvenate those areas, which is one of the poorer aspects of her legacy.
Her funeral's taking place next Wednesday and is said to be the first funeral of a British Prime Minister that the Queen has attended since Churchill's in 1965. How big an occasion is this going to be for the country?
I think it's going to be a very big occasion for the country. People, other prime ministers, presidents, world leaders from all around the globe are going to St. Paul's Cathedral to commemorate the memory of Margaret Thatcher. She really was quite an exceptional woman. She dominated British politics and indeed world politics for 11 and a half years.
Finally, you began by saying that you do admire her.
Mm-hmm.
You also told us that you're a Liberal Democrat. What is it that makes you admire her?
Well, you just have to look at the position that Britain was in 1979. Something had to change. As I said, not all of her policies were fantastic. One of the legacies of Thatcherism was that the rich got a lot richer, but the poor got poorer. And no prime minister at all can be proud of that legacy. However, Britain was in a terrible situation, as I said, in 1979. The unions dominated the economy and the government. They held the government to ransom, demanding 45% pay rises. I mean, that figure, it's inconceivable today that a union would go on strike demanding 45% pay rises. And also, taxation was far too high. For some of the richest people in the country, it was 98%. I don't think anybody today would want to go back to a situation that doesn't encourage wealth as that did. So, but then again, you have to balance it because the manufacturing industry was destroyed under Margaret Thatcher. But then again, she liberated many financial and commercial aspects of the economy. So, yes, one has to take a very balanced look at it.
But generally, you think it was overall a positive legacy, and you're happy to leave behind the things that you don't quite agree with, the equality issues and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, equality issues. You mean like about the rich become rich?
Yeah,
that's a very terrible thing to happen, yes. But overall, I think she did... She led the country in a way that the country had to lead, and she managed to realise that the world, owing to globalisation, was going in that particular direction towards neoliberalism. I think there are excesses of Thatcherism that should be curtailed, especially in terms of social consequences. But when you look at the foundations of the economy that she built, I think it's put Britain in a better place today than it would have been had she not been Prime Minister.
Michael, thank you very much for joining me on the programme today.
Thank you.
And that does bring us to the end of another edition of Alexander Jones Live. We're going to finish slightly early today because we have live drama coming up at 6 o'clock here on Star. There'll be live drama in the Star studio in just a few moments' time, so do stay tuned for that. And I'll be back next week at the same time, 5 o'clock. And if you don't already, do follow me on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Jones News. The whole programme will be available as a podcast very shortly, so you can find that on the Star website. I'm Alexander Jones. Thank you for listening. And I'll see you again next week. Good night.
Tune in to Star, University of St. Andrews radio station.
St. Andrews' only radio station.
This.